Okay, good evening, everybody. Bershus, Mer de Asrot, Shlita. Thank you so much. On behalf of Avinjo Zichrondov, thank you so much, Shark Shemai and Mer de Asrot, for supporting and hosting. It's always a pleasure to do things together and maybe carry on growing and learning and your Shemaim together. Sorry for keeping you all waiting, so I won't give long words of introduction. Welcome to Agada Night, a night of four short Divrei Torah, things you can use for your Seder night. And there are source sheets over here if you didn't get one yet. And without further ado, Mar de Asra, Rav Taylor Shlita, is going to invite to begin.
Thank the Rosh Kollel for his kind and warm remarks. Also want to just acknowledge the fact that tonight's event has been sponsored by Raquel and Jason Goldberg in memory of their daughter Tamima. May the Torah that we learn lead to her neshama to have an aliyah. And may this evening also be a source of comfort to her family who remember her and who keep the flame alive. Also want to just say how wonderful it is to work with Bet Midrash Zichron Dov. I feel very privileged to, very humbled to share a platform with such outstanding educators, Rabbi Mann, Rabbi Sonnenberg, and Mrs. Sonnenberg. Always enjoy working together with you, and done it in the past, we'll do it tonight, and please God, as you said, as the Rosh Kollel said, we'll do it on many occasions going forward too. For many, many years, Halach Ma'anya troubled me. For many years I struggled to connect to this passage. Why? Because of the famous phrase in the second part of it, in the middle part of the paragraph, called the Chvinyei Teve Echol, all who are hungry, come and eat. All who are hungry, come and eat. Okay. I'll speak a bit louder. Oh, the microphone. Oh, okay. Oh, that, okay. Is it working? Hello? That's not working. Okay. Is it on? Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Ostro. Okay. Okay, so for many, many years, this paragraph, I struggled with it, I didn't really understand it. And especially this disingenuous invitation, you know. We've invited our guests for Seder night weeks ago, you know, a month in advance, maybe 6 weeks in advance, 3 weeks in advance if you're not so well organized. But to say all of a sudden, Seder night, you've been to shul, you've davened Maariv, you've walked home, and it's about to be the time of Tzeis, about to be the time when you're going to start the Seder, or even, you know, done Kiddush, and then even after that, you say this. Again, how do we understand this? What is it it's all about? But again, for many, many years I struggled with this question until I came across this incredible insight from the Maaseh Nissim, Rav Eliezer Ashkenazi, who was a fascinating 16th century rabbinic leader. Interestingly, for his time, he lived in Egypt and he lived in Italy and also in Poland and in Prague. He lived in both Ashkenazi and Sephardi countries, which again, now in the 21st century, that's very, very common. But back then, was very, very rare. Anyway, but first, I just want to have an overview of what this paragraph tells us. So, Halach Ma'anya, so this is a bread of affliction that our ancestors ate in Egypt. Fine, that's number one. Number two, we're told, Kol Dechvini Tei Bechol, anyone who is hungry, come and eat. And then, finally, we're told, nowadays, at the moment, we're here, but please God, in the future, we're going to be in Yerushalayim, Lashana Bab Yerushalayim. That's basically what this paragraph is telling us. Matzah is a bed of affliction. All those who are hungry come and eat next year in Yerushalayim. So basically, I've got three questions. Question number one is, what's the famous question on this paragraph? What's the even more than the question that I had? Excellent. Very good. Excellent. Okay. So, question number one. Why is this written in Aramaic? But why? Why is it in Aramaic? So, you might say, well, that was the vernacular at the time. Therefore, this paragraph is in Aramaic. Well, the problem with that is that if this paragraph's in the Aramaic, why isn't the whole Haggadah in Aramaic? Okay, so that's not necessary. So then, but why is this paragraph in Aramaic? So, again, how do we understand this? What's this whole notion about this paragraph being in Aramaic, number one. Number two, Mahakesha, I mean, what's the connection between these three sentences? It's a short paragraph. There's three things. They seem a bit disparate, right? A bed of affliction, all those hungry come and eat, the Shana Barbara Shalayim. They seem very, very random. There must be a kesher. There must be a connection. There must be a thread that ties them all together. That's that question. And then finally, the question which I started off with, what's this fake or disingenuous invitation all about? That's the three questions. Okay. Well, Eliezer Ashkenazi, the Maaseh Nissim, says you can answer all of these questions by understanding one point. What's the one point that you have to understand? That when it comes to happy moments in Judaism, when it comes to happy moments in our faith, yes, we have that great simcha, but our simcha isn't complete. Why is our simcha not complete? Because we don't have the ultimate geula. And therefore, there are certain things that we do as zeichel churban. Remember the fact, yes, we're very happy. This is a great moment of great simcha. But our simcha isn't complete because we don't have the ultimate geula. Therefore, we have to do things that remind us of this. So, obviously, a few examples. Famously, at a wedding. Wedding is a very happy occasion. A wedding is a tremendous simcha. What do? We smash on the glass. One of the reasons given, there are a few reasons given for this. One of the reasons given, obviously, is famously, Zeichel HaChurban, to remember the fact, yes, this is a great simcha, a time of great simcha, but we smash the glass to remind us that we don't have the ultimate geula. Another example, say, in our homes, when we decorate our homes, we have a custom, we have a practice to leave part of the home not furnished. Why? Zeichel HaChurban. Yes, we're living in our own home. Wonderful. We've got our own place, but you know what? Your simcha's not complete. Part of the wall should be not painted or whatever it is. Zeichel HaChurban. So it's funny, in my house in London, in the main living room, in my parents' house, there's a featured wall, right? So again, there's four walls. Three of them are painted, but one of them is a brick wall. It's a featured wall. That's how the house was designed. So I remember as a young kid when Rabbanim used to come to my house. They used to come visit the home and they were like, oh my goodness, Shida and Stuart, wow, Zeichel HaChurban, that's incredible, you know. And anyway, we used to have a good laugh about it. Anyway, so we do various things in our faith, in our tradition, Zeichel HaChurban. Again, to remind us of the fact that yes, it's a great simcha, but our simcha isn't complete. And this notion also, I kind of feel, is appropriate in terms of the situation in Israel. We have great simcha. Yes, we have our own homeland. We have an army that can defend us. We have sovereignty. We have a place that we can call home. And that should call us great simcha. But at the same time, we should just remember that we don't have the ultimate geula. We don't have the ultimate redemption just yet. Please God, that will come with Meir Yomeinu. That will come soon, speedily, in our days. But again, this notion of Zeichel HaChurban, the fact that yes, we there's what to celebrate, but our simcha is incomplete, is also something that I was thinking about earlier today when I was praying for this talk in terms of the situation of Israel. Anyway, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi explains that just by weddings we stamp on the glass, and just by our homes we have a bit which isn't totally decorated, the Zeichel HaChurban of Seder night. The Zeichel HaChurban of Seder night is this paragraph of Halachma Aniya. Because yes, unbelievable, we're free. We're no longer slaves in Egypt. We're a nation. We are Klal Yisrael. But our simcha isn't totally complete because we haven't yet experienced the ultimate redemption. And therefore, says the Maaseh Nissim, says Rabbi Ashkenazi, once you understand that the Zeichel HaChurban of Seder night is this paragraph, now you can understand these three questions. Why Aramaic? Aramaic was the language spoken where in Babel. Babel, Babylon, were the nation who destroyed the first base of Mikdash, and all subsequent exiles ultimately came from Babel. It all comes from there. That's why it is written, this paragraph is written in Aramaic. Right, next. What about the connection between the three? Okay, fine. So it's poor man's bread. Much as poor man's bread. We are poor men. Okay, yes, we might be free. But us, we're poor men because we haven't experienced the ultimate redemption. Okay, the third bit is the easy bit, meaning next year in Jerusalem with the ultimate redemption. So what about this whole disingenuous fake invitation? The Maaseh Nissim explains it as follows. When it came to eating the Korban Pesach, The Korban Pesach had to be eaten b'chabura. The Korban Pesach had to be eaten in a group. You couldn't eat it by yourself. The Korban Pesach was eaten together with a group. And these groups had to be fixed. These groups had to be finalized by Erev Pesach. So therefore, if you came to say tonight, if you came to the 15th of Nisan, and you're like, oh my goodness, I don't have a group. Can I join your group? Can I join your group? Too late. The chaburas, the groups for eating Seidonite, for eating Korban Pesach, had to be set by Erev Pesach. If you got to the 15th, too late, you couldn't join. So therefore, when we say, all those who are hungry, come and eat, when we say, Kol Dechvini Tei Be'echol, we're saying that yes, in theory, someone now can join me for Seidonite. Someone now can join us. Someone now can sit at my table. Why? Because it's Eichel HaChorban. Because if we would have the Beis HaMikdash, if we would have the Alsur Gula, if we would be able to offer the Korban Pesach, you wouldn't be able to join me right now. You wouldn't be able to say all the Dekari come and eat, because the Chaburos are after being set by the previous day. And so therefore, when you say all those are hungry come and eat, when you say Kodek Mene Tei Be'echol, it's because of Zeicha HaChorban. Because if we would have the Beis HaMikdash, this phrase just would not be appropriate. So therefore, Halach Ma'anya, all of our three questions are answered. Halach Ma'anya is the Zeicha HaChorban of the Seder night, just like what the smashing the glass is for a wedding, just like the undecorated bit is for the house. And when I heard this explanation, I got that kind of geschmack feeling. It was like a eureka moment. And it gave me great simcha because it put it into perspective. I had lots of reasons when I was younger which didn't quite do it for me, but this reason did do it for me, and it gave me greater appreciation of this paragraph. And please God, to Mitzvah Hashem, may it do the same thing for all of you. Thank you for coming tonight and have a wonderful Yom Tov.
Shkoyach Rav Taylor, I will be without the mic. So yesterday I found out that both me and the Mar D'Asra, great minds think alike, want to speak about Halach Ma'anya. So me too, I'm also going to speak about Halach Ma'anya, and I will do a brief summary of what the Rav said, and I'll add a few extra answers. So my source sheet is the first page in your source packet. So we're opening the night saying Halach Ma'anya Diachlu Avatana Be'arad Mitzrayim Kol Dich V'Nieti V'Yechol Kol Ditzrich Yeti V'Yivsach. We're opening the night and we're presenting this poor man's bread, this bread of poverty, and we're saying, whoever is hungry, you're more than invited to come and join us. Whoever wants needs a place to eat is invited to come. Kol Ditzrich Yeti V'Yivsach. There are two basic questions that people ask regarding this section. Number one, what is the idea of this invitation? The door is closed. No one is around. No one is hearing you. Who exactly are you inviting? If you really want to invite a person, invite him 6 weeks in advance, or if you're too late, 3 weeks in advance, as the Rav said. That's question number one. And question number two is, there seems to be a stira, a contradiction in this sentence. We're saying, this is bread of poverty. Everyone is more than invited to come and join me. Eat this bread of poverty. This is what you're inviting people for to eat. Last week we had a Clinton Park. We had a steak and wine night in order to persuade guys to come and learn something before Pesach. People come for steak. People come for wine. No one comes for lechem, only for bread of poverty. What is the meaning of inviting? This is bread of poor people. Whoever wants, more invited to come. I have four answers to this question. They're all in front of you in the source sheet. I'll say it bal peh, but if you want to check me afterwards, so look it up and see. So answer number one is what the Rav said. Answer number one, I actually saw it in the name of the Shlo. And the Shlo says, this is not a real invitation. I'm not really inviting anyone to my house for Seder night. Because if I really want to invite a person, I will go in advance. But rather, what am I doing? This is a declaration, a statement of how sorry I am. Why? Because as the Rav said, in the olden days, in times of Beis HaMikdash, when the Beit HaMikdash was built, so a person had to pre-assign and had to have a group before Pesach. So we're saying, if indeed we were in the times of Beit HaMikdash, so in that case, I couldn't invite people over. We had to pre-assign, pre-arrange ourselves, have the tailors and the mans and the Sonnenbergs together already a week in advance. Now that I can invite people over, I'm actually declaring the oy vay voy. There is no Beit HaMikdash. We're now in exile, and that's why we say, L'shana ba b'Yerushalayim. So answer number one is, I'm not really inviting people over. I'm just declaring oy vay, it's so sad. There is no Beit HaMikdash, and that's why people are more than invited, because in previous years, or in years to come, we cannot invite people in this moment. You have to invite people in advance. That's answer number one. Answer number two, you have it in front of you, is the answer given by a rabbi called Rabbi Shlomo Levinstein. He's a very famous Magid Darshan in Eretz Yisrael, and he addresses the question, why is it that we invite people for Lechem Oni, for this bread of poverty, as opposed to Shulchan Orech? We should invite people to come over during Shulchan Orech and say, come over and join us for a wonderful meal. Why are we inviting people for Lechem Oni, for Lach V'Anya? He gives a beautiful answer. He says, I'll tell you why. He says, people that want to bring in guests, who want to be a machnis orchim to their home, and they do so only if they have four different types of meat. They do so only if they have eight different types of herring. They have five wines, and everything is perfect. The house is clean. The kids aren't playing at home for a whole week, because everything has to be spotless for the guests. He says, this is not real hachnasat orchim. This is not legit. This is not real. It's not authentic. It's artificial. A real machnis orchim, a real person that wants to always have his house open for people, doesn't have to have shulchan orech, doesn't have to have four types of meat and ten types of salads and herring and five types of wine, but rather, you're invited to my house no matter what. You're invited to the house even if there's a mess, and even if there's no meat to give you or fine wine, you're always invited. A real, true machnis orchim says, Mikasa, Sukasa, my house is yours. You're always invited. This is a real Magnis Ochim. So this is a message. You're not invited for Shulchan Orech. You are, of course, more than invited. But rather, you're also invited to my house, even if all I have is Lechem Oni. Because I'm always here for you, to listen to you, to speak with you, to give you a smile, to support you. Because a real Magnis Ochim opens his house, even when the house isn't practically perfect in every single way. But rather, only even if there's own lechem oni, you're still more than invited. That's answer number two. Answer of Rabbi Shlomo Levinstein. Answer number three, you have the picture of Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky in your packet. And if you'll see there, he also has a tie of Snoopy. So he actually wrote a whole book about lessons to learn from Charlie Brown and from Snoopy. And he also has quite a few insights on the Haggadah. And he's addressing the question, what is the meaning of inviting people over when the house is closed, the door is closed, no one is around us? How is this a real invitation? This is the question that he is addressing. And Rav Twersky says a beautiful idea. I also kind of learned a new word. He says in the second paragraph, Judaism does not proselytize? That's the word, proselytize? Okay. He says, how do we influence people? What is the PR of Yahadut? What is the public relations of Judaism? We don't go out in the streets and say, I found the light, come join me. We're not trying to persuade people. We're not preaching. We're not trying to convince anyone. This is not our way. On the contrary, if a convert wants to join the Jewish people, the Beis Din is giving him a bit of a rough time. Are you sure? Do you really want it? Do you really, really want it? Are you aware of how difficult it is? How long it takes until we reach Shulchan Orech and Pesach? And how much you have to fast on Yom Kippur? Do you really want... We're not promoting anything. But rather, how are we bringing people to Yahadut? He says, not by promotion, but rather by attraction. When we're going to fill ourselves with the values of Torah and mitzvot, and we're going to fill ourselves with musar and ethics, and become better people as a result of our observance of Torah and mitzvot, as a result, people will want to join us. They will see us and say, wow, this is so beautiful. These people get together once so we can sit together as a family without any devices, and they're together. This is amazing. I want to join. Look at these amazing people. How honest they are in business, how good people they are, how much charity they do. Wow, I want in. The way that we attract, that we bring people to Yahadut is by attraction. I'll give you an example. My wife went shopping, not once, but many times, but she happened to go once shopping with my kids, and after a long day of shopping, so the kids were exhausted, she said, okay, no worries, I'll buy you a treat. So they go inside a candy store. I think it was in Yorkdale. They go into a candy store. And okay, pick whatever you want. There's candy. There's a drink. Whatever you want. Go ahead and pick. So my son runs, finds something. But before he takes it, he says, is this kosher? Can we eat it? Is this our hechsher? Do we rely on this? Is this okay? And then the non-Jewish salesman says to my wife, he says, you know, this is unbelievable. Because, you know, kids are kids. And every single day, kids are tired after a long day of shopping. They come into the store and they roll on the floor. And they're in a tantrum. And they're shouting and they're yelling, I want this, I want that, give it to me now. For your kids, they also want it now, but only if they have the right action. Something is holding back. This is very impressive. Says Rav Tversky, this is our PR, this is our public relations. He says, this is why when we invite people on Seder night, we invite the people when the doors are closed. Meaning, how are we going to open our house? How are we going to invite people to join Yahadut, to join the amazing life of Judaism? By this night of our family getting together. Tonight the doors are closed, and indeed no one's hearing us. But what? We're going to now enhance our relationship. We're going to pass on the tradition from one generation to another generation. We're going to learn the values of Torah and mitzvot and midot. We're going to become amazing people because of this night. And as a result, whoever wants to join us is more than invited. As a result of us becoming better people this night, people will want to join us. And that's why, although the doors are closed, we're now going to enhance our Yahadut, become better people, and now people will want to indeed join us. That's answer number three of Rabbi Dr. Abram Tversky. And answer number four, I have to finish this quickly. This is the answer, my personal favorite answer, the answer of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha. And he, again, raises our questions. He actually raises the question, first of all, how are you inviting a person over by saying, Lechem Honi, this is the bread of poverty of poor people. Whoever wants, come and join me. You should invite for later on. And in addition, as we all know, the matzah has two messages. On the one hand, it's a Lechem Honi. It's bread of affliction of poverty. But on the other hand, it's a symbol of our redemption, of our liberation, of us becoming free people. How does this work? What is the transition? How is it that once it is lechem oni, bread of poverty, and on the other hand it is bread of liberation? Says Rabbi Sacks the following idea, based on a story that he read in the book, If This Is a Man. The book, If This Is a Man, is a biography written by a Holocaust survivor called Primo Levi, and he survived Auschwitz. And in this book, he describes the last days in Auschwitz. He says that the Germans heard that the Russians are coming, and because of that, they abandoned the camp and left behind, they took the Jews who were healthy, somewhat healthy, the marches of death, and those who were unhealthy, they left them behind, and take care of yourself. And he was among those sick people that stayed in the camp. The Germans left with him just a bit of food and some fuel. And you guys manage. And they left. And he says, do you want to know at what point we felt liberated? We felt free people? We felt it at the following case. After a few days, once they got settled in the camp, waiting for the Russians to come. So everything became all right. They had already some heat in their bracket. And Barak, and then at a certain point, one of the people that was sick, named Tovarovsky, so he says, you know what, we have some extra food. Why don't we share our food with those who are working for us and helping us and supporting us, the sick people? And at the moment that we shared the food, he said, that was the turning point. That was the transition. From that point, we felt free. Because usually, when a person is in the camp, what is the law of the camp, the law of prison? Eat your own food, and if you're lucky, eat the food of your friend. Suddenly, we don't think only about ourselves. Suddenly, we think also about other people. Suddenly, we're willing to give food to other people. This is a sign of redemption. This is the sign of free men. A person who is a prisoner, he can't think of other people. But once we thought of other people, now we became free people. Says Rabbi Sacks, this is the reason why we open our night, indeed, with this lechem oni, with this bread of affliction, with this bread of poverty. But we're willing to share. We're now free people because we're willing to give from my food to other people. And a person who's willing to give to another person, this is a characteristic of a free, liberated person. That's why. And this is also the transition between the lechem oni, the bread of affliction, to lechem chirut, bread that represents the liberation of the Jewish people. And that's why we open this night, the night that we are redeemed from Egypt. We're saying, whoever wants to come and join us is more than welcome to come and join us, because we are free people. And free people don't think about themselves, but rather they think about others. May all of us, this coming Pesach, become indeed a free people. Not only think about ourselves, think and care about others. Mezal Hashem will be zoiche, all of us, to celebrate in Beis HaMikdash, the Shana Ba'a B'Yerushalayim.
Evening. The Seder begins with a whole bunch of strange activities that are designed to inspire the children to ask questions. Unfortunately, our children have been educated to the point where they already know that, so they don't ask the question. I had a rabbi in yeshiva, they had the minhag, that instead of just lifting the Seder plate, they got up at that point and just cleared the table. And at that point, the kids say, what's going on? So it worked. It's like you have to kind of like follow the theme of the Seder and try to inspire people to ask questions. And once they've asked the questions, they ask Manishtana, if they didn't ask a question, you give them, you kind of like, you know, have the questions written down for them so they can ask. If they couldn't think of their own questions, they have Manishtana to ask. They ask the questions, and then we start the answer. We start with Avadim Hayinu. I mean, that's they start the question, good question. We give them the answer, Avadim Hayinu. And then the Haggadah just takes a turn and just starts doing this whole meta-analysis. It's not really involved with the answer at all. He says, well, you know, I mean, you asked a great question. Here's the answer, but afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu mzakedim, kulanu yodim et haTorah, even though we're all really smart, mitzvah l'saper et b'siyah mitzvah, it's like, I didn't ask you to tell me how smart you are. I asked a question, and all of a sudden you're patting yourself on the back, we're really smart. It's like, what's going on? It's a little bit strange as the answer. And then the Haggadah continues, and it tells us about the story, about the rabbis, right, with Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azari, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, and that they're talking all night long. It's like, that's very nice, but you're not really answering my question anymore. Now, the kid asked the question, and you're not answering the question. You're telling about some other people who had a lovely meal. And then we hear about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah telling himself, he's talking about, like, you know, he's like Kaven Shivim Shana, and he didn't talk about Yitzhak Mitzrayim Balela, which is like a Mishnah from Brachot. It's like, we had a question, we're trying to figure out what's special about tonight, and you're not answering my question anymore. It seems somewhat strange. I mean, we worked so hard to inspire our children to ask a good question about this night. They ask the question, we give them two lines, and then just like, you know, sometimes parents, we start going ahead and we start talking about things, and the kid's like, where are you? Why aren't you addressing my point? And it seems somewhat strange. The Haggadah should be designed to go ahead and address the children's questions because it works so hard to get them to ask the question. So I'd like to look at these strange pieces of the Haggadah, perhaps, and suggest that they are helping with the question. Because I tell people, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question. The truth of the matter, there is such a thing as a stupid question. But what we're trying to do is what we're trying to encourage people to do is say not to be afraid of asking a question for the fear of feeling foolish. Right? Now, people have this concept. We know in Torah, we say, Ein habayshan lamed. A person who is embarrassed, a person who is worried about looking foolish, won't ask a question. So what's happening here is the Haggadah worked very hard to get the children to ask a question. And now that they asked a question, the Haggadah is continuing to work hard to validate questions. Right? Because not only do we want them to ask, we want them to feel good about their question. So they ask the question, and let's be honest. Manishtana halayla hazemi kol haylot, this is not a very profound question. The rabbis work very hard to try to go ahead and say, okay, what's the deeper meaning? We talk about the idea of maybe there's a slavery and freedom mixed together. Okay, but every night we have bread and now we're having matzah. So, whoa, shakoa shlaimi, you really got that. It's like, they're like, this is not the most profound question. We help them ask questions, and now that they've asked the question, we want them to feel good about it, so that we can continue encouraging more questions throughout the night. So we say, you know what? You asked a great question. We tell you directly, we get you that answer, Avadim Hayinu. And then it says, Vafilu kulanu chachamim kulanu levon. Look, it's mitzvah l'saper b'siyah Mitzrayim. I don't know everything, right? Even though we're really smart, we know everything, we don't know everything. We want to hear more things. I can learn from you. I can learn from my children. They ask these questions. I say, wow, this is really amazing. He says, it's a mitzvah to sapar b'siyah b'Yisrael. The kol amar b'siyah b'Yisrael raisin b'shubach. He says, the more we talk about it, the better. There's nothing that you're telling. I'm telling you things that is meaningful, that is powerful. Even though it's simple, it's something that I've heard before, I want to talk about it. There's no such thing as a foolish question. And I think perhaps the next story with Rabbi Lazar Rabbi Yeshua and the rabbis in Bnei Brak, I think there is something also very powerful, because if you notice, it says what happens, they're really involved in the story, and we go ahead and we say ad shebau talmidim va'amru lehem rabotenu hikiel zman kriyat shema shel shacharit, until their students come and interrupt them. It's like, wow, look at that. The students were educated and they were comfortable interrupting their teachers. There's a teacher says, Rebbe, I just want you to know something. You should stop what you're doing, because there's another thing. You have to do the Shema. It's like, wow. It's like the students are empowered and comfortable to interrupt their teachers. That means that in terms of education, we're saying it's important to have students feel that sense of empowerment and comfort when it comes to their engagement with their teachers. They're allowed to interrupt. They're allowed to ask questions. They're even allowed to perhaps even challenge. Like, should you be continuing with that story now? Or Rebbe, maybe we should be stopping the story and discussing Shema. There's a comfort level between Rebbe and student where the students aren't afraid of interjecting. And then what I really love is the last piece. Rabbi Lazar ben Azari, he says, "Arei ani kaven shivim shana v'lo zechiti she'temer yisrael mitzrayim b'leilot ad shedrasha ben Tzomos." He says, "I'm as if I'm 70 years old again." So he's not 70; he's still a young man. But nonetheless, he's saying, "I hadn't figured this out yet until Ben Zoma came up with this thing, and he hadn't figured it out until Ben Zoma came up with this idea." And what was the idea? He says, "Because he figures it out from the pasuk leman tiskor yom seidcha meres yisrael kol yamei chayecha," and he makes this whole drasha. And he figured it out. Now, I happen to personally love learning Torah where you figure something out. I don't know, it happens every year, every parsha, where you see something that you didn't see before. You see it, it's like, how come I never saw that before? I've read it my entire life, and only this year did I see it. My favorite one, personally, was when I noticed that when Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock, he was in a velus. I never put the connection. The parshios go together, right? That Miriam dies. That's why they ran out of water. That's why they start complaining. And they come to the Shiva house to tell Moshe Rabbeinu that there's no water. And all of a sudden, I was like, I can't believe it. I missed that. My entire life, you focus on the story, but you don't. I missed the picture. I just completely missed that point. And it opened up a whole bunch of ideas for me. But again, the idea of seeing the story for the first time, after it's the 10th time, 20th time, 30th time. And here we go, and we see this story of Rabbi Lazar ben Azari saying, I didn't see this. It's a pasuk in the Torah. It's not like, you know, this crazy drasha. It says, I saw this, but I read it my entire life. He knew the pasuk, I guarantee it. He knew the pasuk, but he never saw this. It's like the first time he saw it. And Ben Zoma also, again, he came up with this idea. Ad shedrasha ben Zoma. He says, wow, you can go ahead and you can see things, and the questions that are asked, we say we learn the most from our students. When a good question, when a question comes, an innocent question from a child, the most simple thing, and I look at it through different eyes, I gain new insight and I gain new ideas. And what the Haggadah is telling me is that the children should be aware that they're part of this process. The give and take between teacher, student, parent, child, the ability to see the Torah from this new perspective is in fact providing us with greater insight that we never had before. And had we not had these questions, had we not had the children come and push that agenda and this new idea, I would have never seen it. And we're telling the children, these questions are valuable, these questions are meaningful, and these questions are what move the story along and allow the transmission of Torah to actually work. Because the only way to learn is to have questions that go back and forth, and this is the idea of the Seder. So the Seder is this twofold idea. We want to encourage children to ask questions, we want to answer their questions, and the most important thing is, we want to validate their questions, because validating questions is what is going to eventually encourage more questions. The first question is always the hardest. At the end of the night, everybody says, anybody have any questions? And everybody says, blank rivers. Okay, let's start with the second one. Right, the same. But like, nobody wants to ask questions. But once we've got the first one rolling, then questions start coming. As long as we've worked hard to validate questions and encourage the questions. So I wish everybody a meaningful Seder, a Seder full of questions, a Seder full of connection, and a Seder full of learning from one another.
We're almost at the finish line. I wanted to also thank the Goldbergs for sponsoring tonight, and I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so happy that I'm speaking about Jewish mothers and Jewish parents. So, yes. How's that? Usually I use my teacher voice. I might stop in the middle as I get more enthusiastic. All right, so we're talking about a medrash that is sort of it springs off of something that we say in Magid. So in Magid we talk about, say, Umad, what did Lavan want to do to Yaakov Avinu? Paro, he wasn't so bad. He only made a decree on the males. But Lavan, he really wanted to ruin the whole thing. He wanted to just destroy the Jewish people. And how do we know that? Because the pasuk says, "Arami oved avi vayered mitzrayma vayagarsham bimtei me'at vayihisham legoy gadol atzum barav." An Aramean was destroying my father. He went down to Egypt. He resided there with a small number. And he became their nation, great, powerful, and numerous. Barav. Actually, Sefaria translates it as numerous, but many people say it's not a noun, numerous. It's actually a verb, barav. And they were increasing. They were getting more and more numerous as it happened. And so each of these pieces of that proof text, we pull out and we darshan. We try to go broader, we try to go deeper. If you see, I don't know if you've noticed this phenomenon, but I noticed it more recently on a bus shelter. There's like a picture, an ad for the show The Good Doctor, and it's a picture of his face, and each of the pieces is actually a little picture from the show. But if you step back, you see a different picture. So that's sort of what the Medrash does for us, right? It gives us all these little pieces that together give us more insight. And then the word barav, that last word barav, comes from rivava ketzemach hasadeh netetif. When we start analyzing, we see these psukim from Yechezkel about the foundling girl who was born in the field and had nobody to clean her and nobody to care for her. And Hashem came and cleaned her up and ended up marrying her when she grew up. And those verses are the jumping off point for a medrash, and that medrash is cited in the Gemara that you have in front of you. So all of that is to say, we're going to look a little bit at the medrash as quoted in the Gemara, and see if we can understand a little bit more. The medrash is this very fantastical story, and what we want to understand is, well, what's really behind it? Medrash is generally not speaking literally. It's not trying to give us a factual story. It's trying to give us truth. Right, so I think Simi Peters said it in her amazing book, Learning to Read and Grudge. She says something can be true even if it's not factual. So I think that's very much what the Midrash is doing. So, Deresh Rabbi Avira. Rabbi Avira taught, in the merit of righteous women, Yischar Nashim Tzidkaniot, Shehayu Be'oto Ador, Nig'alu Yisrael Mimitzrayim. The Jewish people was redeemed because of the righteous women in that generation. He gives this amazing story of what the Jewish women did to be so righteous. When they came to draw water, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mezamen lahem dagim, Hashem would make appear for them, he would materialize. There's no good, well, maybe there was a good English translation, and my English is just not good enough. But Hashem would make appear little fish in the water, and so they would draw pitchers that were half fish and half water, and then they would come, and they put two pots on the fire, one of hot water and one of fish. And in Yaakov, the Chidshei Gaonim tries to help us understand what this Midrash is really talking about. So the main piece here, with the thing that the women did, that we know that they did, that the men were not ready to do, that the men were not capable at that point of doing, is actually reproducing. The men had given up. When Paro's decree was put into place, The men gave up. They said, forget it. There's no point in having children. They're just going to get killed. They're going to be put in the bricks in the buildings. There's no point. And the women were, not so fast, not so fast. So the image of the pitchers full of water and fish represent, right? So the hot water represents, you know, things heating up, and the fish represent the children that they had. And the pitcher represents their stomach. It's from a different proof text somewhere else that the stomachs are called pitchers, and they had lots of little fish in their pitchers. They had lots of children in their stomachs. And the fish symbolize, of course, the vid gularov, they should multiply like fish, like the many, many children that Bnei Israel had. And they also symbolize our inability to know what's going to happen to us. Because fish can be caught in a net without being aware, and all of a sudden they're lifted out of the water and they're lost. But they didn't see it coming. There's a proof text about that as well. So that's the symbol of the fish. And the women approach the men in two ways. They approach them psychologically, and they approach them physically, right? So they had the hot water, things were getting exciting, there are lots of midrashim saying how the women would encourage their husbands and sort of joke with them and flirt with them. But there's also the idea that the women said, look, here's what's going on, okay? Paro's made this decree. It's true. It's not looking good, I admit. But don't try to make cheshbonos, don't try to make calculations on Hashem's behalf. If Hashem wants our children to be lost, He has lots of agents. It's not just Paro who's out to get us. It's not just Paro that you have to be worried about. But if Hashem wants us to grow and flourish, we're good. It's all set. And so, don't worry. You do what you're supposed to do, and Hashem will do His part. So they would come to their husbands, and they would feed them the fish, and they would give them the water, and they would be intimate with them within the ben svatayim, between the folds. The folds, the sheepfolds, is a very special boundary between fields. It doesn't belong to this field, and it doesn't belong to that field. It's a separate fence. It's part of its own sort of landform or character. And that represents something that's different from everything else, something that's just one, it's not part of anything else. That represents the unity of Hashem, and it represents the women's desire, not for their own pleasure, not for their own, you know, have somebody to bring them the stuff from the basement, but they wanted children because they wanted to express and represent Hashem's unity in the world. That's our job. That's what the Jewish people do. And that's all they wanted. And that's represented by the idea of lying with their husbands between the folds, between the sheepfolds. And because of that, you'll see there's another proof text explaining that for that reason, they deserved the riches of Mitzrayim. And then the women get pregnant. Things are going well. And they go back home. They gestate that baby. And when they're ready to give birth, they come out and they give birth under the apple trees. And the apples represent the Jewish people. Just like an apple tree, the fruit grows before the leaves do. So too, Bnei Israel said, Na'aseh, we will do, before they said, Nishma, we will hear, we will understand, we'll figure it out, we'll have a good basis. No. The Jews are ready, no matter what. And so Hashem, when they had these babies, Hashem sent angels. V'kadosh Baruch Hu sholech mishnei marom, mishe menacher u'meshaperotam, kechaya zu shemeshaperotat adlad. Hashem sent angels to clean up the babies and improve them and get them all set. And again, a proof text, because the babies, they had to be born in the fields, they were afraid of the Egyptians, and Hashem would bring them these two cakes, one of oil and one of honey. And that represents the Torah, which is both sweet like honey and illuminating like oil, or it represents the sweetness, the physical nourishment of the honey, and the oil, the spiritual nourishment of the Torah, the wisdom that they were taught. And these babies were taught by the angels tremendous intellectual, spiritual understandings. And what happened was that Kevan Shemakirim Bahem Mitzrim Bayin Lahargan, the Mitzrim noticed that all these babies were being born. There's two ways to understand this. Either the Mitzrim just saw the physical babies were being born and they came to kill them. That was their job. And Hashem hid them, right? Hashem made a miracle that they were swallowed by the earth. So they weren't actually swallowed by the earth. That doesn't generally go well. Ask Korach how it was. But in this case, the Midrash is saying they were hidden so well that it was as if the earth swallowed them. Like, where'd they go? What happened? And the Midrashim weren't able to find them. Or another way of understanding is that, you know, when you're under such pressure and hardship, you don't have time to be spiritual. You don't have time to be intellectual. You don't have time to think great thoughts. And that's exactly what the Egyptians wanted. They wanted the Jews downtrodden. They wanted the Jews too busy to think, too busy to try to get out of Mitzrayim, too busy to try to overcome them, which was Pharaoh's great worry, right? So they worked them harder and harder. And when Moshe came and they started thinking, Power work them harder. That was his strategy, right? But the being ground down in the dirt represents sort of this unrefined, boorish, uncivilized manner of being, and being raised by the angels represents this tremendous gift of spirituality that they had. So when the Egyptians came, right, when the Egyptians heard, when they noticed that the Jews were so refined and so spiritual, the Egyptians came to try to kill them. But Hashem made a miracle that they acted still base and unrefined and unlearned. And so the Egyptians weren't able to see what was really going on. And then the Egyptians, of course, were pretty mad. And as we said, their strategy was to crush the Jewish people physically in order to crush them spiritually. And so what they did was they plowed on their backs, right? You see the pasuk saying that they plowed on their backs like oxen. And that represents, of course, the hard labor that's fit only for animals. And again, it was an attempt to destroy them spiritually. But despite that, their intelligence grew like grass, right? It would grow and sprout from the hard earth upwards like grass. And the commitment, and because of that commitment that the Jewish woman had, when the sea split, those little children were the ones that pointed and said, Zeh keli vaveo. They're the ones who recognize Hashem from their previous experience, having connection with the angels, having the intellectual and spiritual greatness to be able to see Hashem when the sea split. That was something that they got because of the commitment and the sacrifice of their Jewish mothers and, of course, of their Jewish fathers as well. Maybe they need a little bit more encouragement, but they did it in the end. And I think certainly in our day when we see the Jewish nation, which is the representative of Hashem's unity in this world, and we see the struggles that they have, and we see the incredible strength and commitment and sacrifice of the parents and of the children, of the wives, the husbands, the sons, the daughters, we see that that sacrifice that's in our DNA is still alive and well. And we see the power of that sacrifice and commitment and where it will lead us, please God, speedily in our days.
Okay, so that's it for tonight. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much, Shart Shamayim, for hosting. Thank you so much, the Goldberg family, for sponsoring Lulim Shema of Tamima. And hopefully this was an inspiring night. And may all of us, with Hashem, have a wonderful, wonderful Pesach. We still have time to celebrate Pesach of us together in Yerushalayim, Bezrat Hashem. If we won't be in Yerushalayim, so there is B'Hashem a planned Shabbaton, B'Midrash Zichron Dov, with our Rosh B'Midrash Emeritus, Rabbi Turchina Shlita, Shabbos,
it's in
May 18th, something like that. So everyone are more than invited to attend, and all of us have a Chag Pesach Kasher V'Sameach. Thank you so much. So this was cool.